Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, August 18th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, MMH Leaders Discourage Indoor Events, by Caitlin Randall. As the number of COVID-19 patients at Midland Memorial Hospital continues to rise, up to 95 on Tuesday, hospital officials encourage community members to cancel large gatherings. If you are responsible for gatherings, for meetings at your company, for an event that's being held indoors that brings people together, you should seriously consider postponing, canceling, or making those gatherings purely virtual, MMH CEO and President Russell Myers said during a press briefing. The spread of the virus is real, it's rapid, it's hard to stop. It's very difficult to have a safe indoor gathering right now. Coronavirus hospitalizations have increased dramatically in the last few weeks, from single digits in the beginning of July to nearly 100 COVID-19 patients on Tuesday. The percentage of residents testing positive for the virus has also increased from about 10% to 33% over the same time period, Myers said. The best advice we can give anybody is to avoid being in groups and avoid being in enclosed spaces, especially if they're poorly ventilated, he said. Myers recommended that anyone who must be in public spaces, whether vaccinated or unvaccinated, wears a mask and follows social distancing guidelines. Several organizations have already announced that they will be canceling or postponing events. Summer Mummers canceled this weekend's shows because of the spike in cases, and Pink the Basin has opted to postpone its annual October luncheon. Midland County also announced that upcoming jury trials will be canceled. This is the local page. This article is entitled, Report, Midland Health Leader Tests Positive, from Staff Reports. Chief Nursing Officer Kit Bredemus has tested positive for COVID-19, according to a family member's social media post. Bredemus has been one of the faces for Midland Health during the COVID-19 pandemic, even speaking to the Midland City Council when it was debating mask mandates for the community. Midland Health officials wouldn't address Bredemus's case, following HIPAA guidelines, but said those vaccinated for COVID are not 100% protected, and they expect breakthrough cases. They also restated their position that those vaccinated are at lesser risk of winding up in the hospital if they end up testing positive for COVID. Of the 93 COVID patients in the hospital this morning, 12 are vaccinated, according to Midland Health officials. This article is entitled Things to Know from MMH's COVID Briefing, by Caitlin Randall. As COVID-19 hospitalizations at Midland Memorial Hospital continue to spike, here are the main takeaways from Tuesday's hospital press briefing. Officials reported there were 93 COVID-19 patients in the hospital Tuesday morning, up 6 from the previous day and 14 from last Thursday. 22 of those patients are in critical care and 20 are on ventilators. The age range of COVID-19 patients continues to skew younger than in previous surges. Officials reported the following age breakdown: 9 patients in their 20s, 18 in their 30s, 16 in their 40s, 3 in their 80s. The number of vaccinated patients in the hospital continues to align with the reported efficacies of Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson vaccines. Officials said that 80% of the COVID-19 patients on Tuesday were unvaccinated, which came to a total of 12 breakthrough cases in the hospital. The age range of the breakthrough patients is 51 to 87. Officials said there were 2 COVID-19 patients in the labor and delivery ward because they were actively in labor. The percentage of residents testing positive for the coronavirus at Midland Health sites is at 33%, up from about 10% a month ago. The CDC has recommended booster shots for vaccinated individuals who are severely immunocompromised, such as those who have received organ transplants. Hospital officials said they would have more information on booster shots available by Thursday. Officials recommended canceling or delaying community gatherings, saying it's very difficult to have a safe indoor gathering right now. Both vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals should be wearing a mask in public and socially distancing because of the viral load in the community, officials said. The emergency department is overwhelmed, and hospital officials ask that residents not come to the ER solely to receive a COVID-19 test. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Larry Wilson said residents should seek treatment from their primary care physicians unless they are experiencing severe symptoms such as difficulty breathing. This article is entitled Permian Basin Water and Energy Conference Dates Announced. From staff reports. On Monday, the University of Texas Permian Basin and industry officials announced the 2022 dates for the Permian Basin Water in Energy Conference. The Permian Basin Water in Energy Conference, which will take place February 22nd to the 24th in Midland, connects industry leaders and researchers, sharing best practices and cutting-edge approaches to some of the oil and gas industry's most pressing issues, according to event officials. The UT Permian Basin College of Business Advisory Council, with Jim Woodcock at the helm, planted the idea for the conference in 2017. The Shepherd Leadership Institute at UTPB is the home for the PWIEC, allowing students to benefit from the conference proceeds. Those expected to appear at the conference include Christy Craddock of the Texas Railroad Commission, Don Evans and Tracy Bentley of the Permian Basin Strategic Partnership, Robert Kaplan of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, Ben Shepherd of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, and Todd Staples of the Texas Oil and Gas Association. For more information or to register, go to waterinenergy.com. This article is entitled Oil Posts Longest Run of Losses Since March by Ari Hawkins, Bloomberg. Oil fell for the fourth day, marking its longest run of losses since March, pressured by a rising dollar and economic data illustrating the U.S. recovery's uneven path. Futures declined 1% on Tuesday. The dollar climbed, weakened the appeal of commodities priced in the currency. U.S. retail sales fell in July by more than forecast, while factory production strengthened the most in 4 months. Data from China on Monday revealed a slowdown in the economy last month. Poor data coming out of China is ground zero for reignited global concerns surrounding COVID-19, says Phil Flynn, senior market analyst at Price Futures Group. Although indicators in the U.S. show a better situation than China, as the second largest economy, what happens in the region has huge market impact. Meanwhile, the industry-funded American Petroleum Institute reported U.S. crude stockpiles fell 1.16 million barrels. The U.S. government will release its supply data on Wednesday. After a vigorous rally in the first half of the year, crude's advance has been checked in recent weeks. The Delta variant has spurred fresh curbs on mobility in many nations, including China, harming energy consumption. Against that backdrop, J.P. Morgan Chase & Company has been among banks reducing oil price forecasts. China is the world's engine for participated demand growth, says Thomas Finland, director of Energy Analytics Group, LLC. When demand shows signs of a downturn, you can be sure the effects will spread. While demand has been challenged, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies, including Russia, has stayed the course in relaxing their output curbs imposed in the early phase of the pandemic. Supplies will rise by 400,000 barrels a day this month. With prices softening, OPEC Plus delegates said they don't see a need to accelerate the revival of output, despite a call from U.S. President Joe Biden last week for the cartel to restore more production to bring gasoline prices down. The group's next regular meeting is set for September 1st. The API also reported inventories at the nation's biggest storage hub at Cushing, Oklahoma, fell 1.74 million barrels last week. That will be the biggest decline since June if the EIA report matches it. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, August 18th. Angela Diane Kelly. Angela Diane Kelly of Midland passed away Thursday, August 12th, at the age of 46. Diana was born January 29, 1975, in Big Spring, Texas, and adopted by Joe and Dean Kelly at an early age. Diane was preceded in death by her father, Joseph L. Kelly, and her mother, Dean Kelly. She is survived by her brother, Dean Kelly, and wife, Terry of Midland, two half-sisters, and one half-brother. Visitation will be held at Nallie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, August 20th. The family would appreciate donations to Kindred Hospice, 1031 Andrews Highway, Suite 203, Midland, or Mesa Animal Rescue Group, P.O. Box 6016, Midland, 79704. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Dalton J. Smith. Dalton J. Smith passed away in Midland on August 13th at the age of 86. He was born November 14, 1934 in Stamford, Texas, to Charles and Gladys Smith. He was preceded in death by his wife Courtney Ann and son Clayton J. Smith. He is survived by his children, Stephen Eric, Joel David and wife Kim, Shelley Lynn and husband Eddie Hollams, and Jay's daughter-in-law Susan Smith. 11 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren. Jay's sister Joanne and husband Alvin, as well as nieces, nephews and cousins. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 18th at Rest Haven Memorial Park. In lieu of flowers, donations to the Alzheimer's Foundation would be appreciated. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Gwenna Hand. Gwenna May Hand went to be with the Lord Friday, August 13th. Gwenna was born to Volley and Lucille Grimes, October 29, 1944, in Amherst, Texas. She married David Hand on June 20, 1970, in Midland. Gwenna is preceded in death by her husband, David Hand, parents Volley and Lucille Grimes. Gwenna is survived by her daughter, Tracy, Kent Schwischau, son, David, Carla Hand, two brothers, Thurman and Ronnie Grimes, six grandchildren, four great-grandchildren. Visitation will be Wednesday, August 18th at Ellis Funeral Home. Graveside services are set for 9 a.m. Thursday, August 19th at Rest Haven Memorial Park with Debbie Huff officiating. Margaret Eileen Martin Ridgway. Margaret Eileen Martin Ridgway went on to glory Wednesday, August 11th at the age of 84. A memorial service for Margaret will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 21st at the 14th and Main Church of Christ in Big Spring. Margaret was born in Big Spring to William Boynton Martin Preach and Mary Grace Phillips Martin on July 28, 1937. Margaret was preceded in death by her husband, Roger, and her parents. She leaves behind her three children, Patty LaBombard, David, Nancy Collins, Doug, and John Ridgway, Angela, nine grandchildren, 21 great-grandchildren, and several nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that you send donations to the Alzheimer's Research. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelsh.com. Dr. J.W. Donaldson. Dr. J.W. Donaldson, 89, passed away on August 12, 2021. J.W. was preceded in death by oldest son Scott Donaldson, wife of nearly 55 years, Anne Dunn Donaldson, parents M.L. and Esther Donaldson, and siblings Curtis Donaldson, Willie Donaldson, and Dale Sis Baugh. J.W. is survived by his daughter and son-in-law Joyce Ann and Fred Hoog, and his youngest son J. Weldon Donaldson. Siblings John Donaldson and wife Margaret, Joe Pat Donaldson, Teeny Ferguson and husband Russ, Doris Prater and husband Sonny, Jerry Nub Donaldson and wife Carolyn, Linda Lujan and husband Barry, Dwight Donaldson, sister-in-law Laurie Dunn, and many nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, Joyce Ann and Jay request you continue their parents' support of Bethany United Methodist Church Children's Ministry. A memorial service and his interment at Bethany United Methodist Church, located at 10010 Henderson Mill Road, Austin, 78750, will be announced at a later date. Rebecca Lowe Tienert. Rebecca Lowe Tienert of Midland was welcomed home by her Heavenly Father on Sunday, August 15th. Rebecca was born December 12, 1948 in Midland to Teresa and Homer Allen Lowe Jr. Survivors include her husband, John Tienert, daughters Katrina Kinseth and husband Dean of Corinth, Texas, Holly McConnell and husband Hank of Midland, three granddaughters, her brother, Reverend J. Allen and Shirley Lowe of Corpus Christi, and sister Lavanya Friday of Leander, Texas. Rebecca was preceded in death by her parents, Teresa and Homer Allen Lowe, Jr. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be made to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital or the Building Fund for Fellowship Baptist Church. Visitation will be Wednesday, August 18th, from 6 to 8 p.m. Services to celebrate the life of Rebecca will be held Thursday, August 19th at 10 a.m., with graveside services to follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Location of visitation and memorial service will be Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. The family invites you to wear blue in her honor. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelsh.com. Thomas Michael Patrick Joseph O'Brien. Thomas Michael Patrick Joseph O'Brien passed away on Sunday, August 15th, after a courageous battle with prostate cancer. Thomas was born at the Herman Hospital, Houston, Texas, on May 17, 1933. He was preceded in death by his parents, Mary Hino O'Brien and Jerome Joseph O'Brien, and his daughter, Tracy Maria O'Brien Westlake. He leaves behind his beloved wife, Mary Christian, Chrissy Grant O'Brien, his daughters, Kim O'Brien Jordan of Culver City, California, Karen Christine O'Brien of Carlsbad, California, Taryn O'Brien Johnston and her husband, Dara of Australia, Kelly Williamson, Robert Williamson and his wife, Robin. He is also survived by his five grandchildren, and he leaves behind many friends and relatives. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, August 20th, at Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home Chapel. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelsh.com. Death Notices. Earl Kenneth Duhon. Earl Kenneth Duhon, 93, passed away August 16th. Mr. Duhon is survived by his three daughters, Janine Duhon, Rebecca Maynor, Penelope Torelli, two sons, Gregory Duhon, Kenneth Thomas, one sister, and three grandchildren. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com. Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home is honored to serve the Duhon family at this time. Gerald Dennis Laney. Gerald Dennis Laney, 80, of Midland, passed away on August 14th at Midland Memorial Hospital. Gerald was born on December 6, 1940, to J.W. and Minnie Elizabeth Campbell Laney in Kilmichael, Mississippi. He is survived by five children: Nanda Dennis, Sam, Stephanie Laney, Mary Sanchez, Chastity Baker, Bruce, Amanda Dixon, Stephen, and Israel Patino. Visitation will be held on Thursday, August 26th from 5 to 8 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral services will be on Friday, August 27th at 1 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home with Taylor Nunez officiating. Burial will take place at American Heritage Cemetery. Karen Michelle Long. Karen Michelle Long, 60, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, July 29th. Celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 21st, at Golf Course Road Church of Christ. Survivors include her mother, Barbara Long, and sister, Barbara Long Hershey. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. This article is entitled MISD. 97% of positive had no vaccine. Board discusses impact of COVID-19 on district thus far. By Stuart Doreen. Governor Greg Abbott has told school districts that they cannot impose mask mandates on their staff and student population. But that didn't stop the Midland ISD School Board from talking about COVID-19 at its meeting on Monday night. COVID-19 cases through Tuesday morning are up to 462, 358 students, and 104 staff. Of those, more than 300 are active cases, according to the district, 264 students and 41 staff. And according to Imogene Douglas, Director of Health Services for the district, 97% of the cases are those that are unvaccinated. On Monday, there was discussion on both sides of the debate about how much the district should be doing. Katie Joyner stated that the number of students and staff infected is a small percentage of the overall MISD student and staff population, and that people are just living their lives right now. Joyner has been critical of past efforts involving the district and state when it comes to COVID. She was the most vocal member of board members when mask mandates were in effect. She dug in with the most questions about the current COVID situation in the community, what she has read online about COVID, the Delta variant, and what has taken place elsewhere, even abroad. She was critical of the district staff memorandum that went out to parents that she said created confusion about students that had been in contact with people with COVID-19. The district needs to make clear this is a parent discretion, Joyner said during the meeting. MISD officials said the intention wasn't to communicate that parents didn't have the right to send an uninfected student to campus. Robert Marquez said the district has the right to oversee some safety and welfare measures like nutrition and certain protocols that are in place when child abuse is suspected. We are, at the local level, responsible for the well-being of the student, Marquez said. If the situation gets bad enough, how are we going to operate the system? Superintendent Angelica Ramsey and Douglas stated that layered mitigation efforts would continue and that the district would continue to recommend but not mandate that masks and social distancing would be practiced. Ramsey reminded the board that the school district is the largest employer in Midland and the impact of COVID on staff went beyond teachers in the classroom. Ramsey said those working in transportation and custodians could also be impacted. The MISD board later talked about adding more paid time off for those employees infected with COVID.
Hello, this is Cindy reading Health and Wellness from the MRT for Wednesday. Less weight, less risk from COVID-19. Padmaja Patel, MD, Midland Health. One of the most striking observations from the COVID-19 pandemic has been that the virus adversely affects those who are obese. About 30% of hospitalizations have been attributed to obesity, and risks of hospitalization, intensive care unit admission, invasive mechanical ventilation, and death were higher with increasing BMI, body mass index. We know that being obese is linked to impaired immunity, and it also lowers lung capacity, which can make ventilation more difficult and increase chances of poor outcomes from the infection. Obesity is a complex disease with many different contributing factors, factors that we often do not talk about, like neighborhood design, access to affordable, healthy, and nutritious foods and beverages, and having safe and convenient places for physical activity, all impact obesity. There are racial and ethnic disparities in obesity that bring attention to the need to address social determinants of health, such as poverty, education, and housing. To lower your risk from the COVID-19 infection, first, you need to take the vaccine if you have not already done so. To address obesity in a community, system-wide changes can happen when policymakers and community leaders work together to ensure that their communities, environments, and systems support a healthy, active lifestyle for all. In addition to the steps to slow the spread of COVID-19, adopting a healthy lifestyle can help protect you and your families during the pandemic. Eating a healthy diet. A population-based case control study in 6 countries involving a web-based survey of close to 3,000 frontline healthcare workers from 6 countries over a 3-month period in 2020 regarding their demographics, dietary patterns, and COVID-19 outcomes show the following findings. Plant-based and plant-predominant diets rich in vegetables, legumes, and nuts offered clinical outcomes benefits in those who develop COVID-19. Those consuming diets including greater amounts of poultry, red and processed meats were at greater risk of moderate to severe COVID-19. Low-carb, high-protein dietary patterns caused close to 4-fold increased odds of moderate to severe COVID-19 compared to those who consume a more plant-predominant diet. A diet with plenty of fruits and vegetables, legumes, and whole grains is important for your health and can help with weight loss and prevent weight gain. Well-balanced nutrition can help support optimal immune function. Other factors. Physical activity. The COVID-19 lockdown has promoted unhealthy behaviors, including excessive screen time, consumption of comfort foods and excess sugar consumption, social isolation, and decreased physical activity. There is a growing body of evidence that indicates that exercise may help boost our immune responses and our body's ability to fight infections. In addition, it can lower our risk for weight gain and all other risks associated with obesity. The recommendation for adults 18 to 64 years old is to do at least 150 to 300 minutes, about 5 hours, of moderate intensity, or 75 to 150 minutes, about 2.5 hours, of vigorous intensity activity weekly, along with 2 or more days weekly of strength training. The more physical activity, the more benefit, but any amount of exercise is better than none. Sleep. Inadequate sleep has been linked to heart disease, diabetes, and obesity, all of which can increase your risk of COVID-19 infection. Adults should strive toward getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep in 24 hours. Sleep is an extremely important part of our health. Negative effects of sleep delays or interruptions include a sluggishness, low attention span, decreased sociability, depressed mood, decreased deep sleep, decreased caloric burn during the day, increased hunger and decreased feeling of fullness, insulin resistance and decreased performance. Stress management. Stress from the pandemic can cause anxiety, lack of sleep, and excessive alcohol and tobacco consumption. All of these can lead to weight gain and worsening chronic diseases, which may increase the risk of COVID-19 infection. Stress is unavoidable in our modern life. How we think about it and how we react to it makes the difference in how it impacts our self-care and our health. While some medications may help to manage stress, there are many things that you can do to help you manage stress and improve overall health. At the Lifestyle Medicine Center, we are now offering a new program, the Complete Health Improvement Program. The CHIP program is a research-tested lifestyle medicine solution designed to improve your health and well-being while helping you lose weight. Unlike live-in lifestyle interventions, CHIP is affordable and community-based. Participants achieve lasting change by applying their new learning in the real-life environment of their kitchens, local grocery stores, and restaurants. Trained CHIP facilitators use current adult educational techniques in a dynamic group setting to achieve an atmosphere of accountability and support. As a part of enrollment, participants will have access to the CHIP online portal that offers books, educational videos, and other resources. How is it implemented? 18 sessions are delivered over 10 weeks. Each session contains equal amounts of filmed information and group discussion, interaction, and practical application. CHIP principles are based on regular exercise, plant-based whole foods, adequate water intake, rest, and stress management. At the Lifestyle Medicine Center, this program will be delivered in a unique setting where a physician will medically supervise the program. Participants will have access to additional support like nutritional counseling with a dietitian, health coach counseling, weekly educational classes, grocery tours, and referral to a community support group. If you are ready to take charge of your health or have questions, please call 221-LIFE, 5433. Hello, this is Cindy reading Life and Times from the Odessa American for Sunday. Homecoming. Gatlin Brothers return to perform in the Permian Basin, by Michael Bauer. The Gatlin Brothers may currently reside in Tennessee, but Odessa will always be their home. They'll get a chance to finally come back and perform in the Permian Basin with a show on August 20th titled An Evening with the Gatlin Brothers at the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center in Midland. While it's certainly not the first time they've taken center stage at the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center, it'll be the Gatlin Brothers' first time back in the Permian Basin in a couple of years. The Gatlin Brothers, made up of Larry, Steve, and Rudy, are a Grammy Award-winning group that has dazzled audiences for more than six decades and have accrued a lifetime of noteworthy achievements in their storybook career. They've had the honor of playing at many different famous stages across the country, from the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, Tennessee, to Carnegie Hall in New York City. But for the Gatlin Brothers, nothing beats getting to come home to the Permian Basin. It's good to be coming home, Larry said. It's good to be at the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center. It's one of our favorite places. It's state-of-the-art. It's a comfortable, warm, friendly place to play. I'm going to see a bunch of old friends and maybe play some golf at Midland Country Club. Rudy and Steve echoed those thoughts. We have a lot of friends out there, and the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center is a beautiful theater, Rudy said. We've performed in beautiful theaters all over the country. It's a beautiful theater, and I'm not just saying that because it's our home. It's a great size. We've done a couple of concerts there throughout the years. It's good to come home and see the home folks. We've worked rodeos and fairs. We've worked all kinds of venues and symphonies. It's great coming home. For Steve, it's not only going to be good to be back home, but it also felt great to get back to performing on a regular basis after COVID brought everything to a standstill last year. It's a wonderful place, and it's a wonderful time to be back out in West Texas, Steve said. We've been pretty isolated. We've done about 10 or 15 shows in the last 18 months, and most of them were before everything shut down last year. Since then, the Gatlin Brothers schedule has picked up. They'll perform at the Charlie Daniels Volunteer Jam in Nashville on August 18th, before arriving in the Lone Star State for a show at the Hippodrome Theater in Waco on August 19th, right before they come to Midland. We're going to have a nice last half of the year, Steve said of this year. We have a nice Texas swing. We'll be in Waco before going to the Permian Basin. The Wagner Knoll is a wonderful place to perform. From the time that you go backstage to the time you walk out the front door, the folks are great and treat us well and the sound is good. Among the many awards that the Gatlin Brothers have received include a Grammy for Best Country Song for Broken Lady, 3 American Country Music Awards for Single of the Year, All the Gold in California, and Album of the Year for Straight Ahead. Their chart-topping single, Houston, Means I'm One Day Closer to You, is ranked among Billboard's greatest of all-time hot country songs. The brothers have also accumulated 7 number one singles, 32 top 40 records, as well as more than 20 studio albums and 5 BMI Millionaire Awards. All 3 brothers graduated from Odessa High with Larry in 1966, followed by Steve in 1969, and Rudy in 1970. They all played baseball growing up, and Larry played football for the Odessa High Broncos, serving as quarterback and helping the team to a district title in 1964 with a 6-4-1 overall record during his junior year and claiming the bragging rights against his crosstown rivals, Permian. When we tell people we're from Odessa, they say Mojo, Larry said. You can talk about Mojo if you want, but I went 2-1 against them. Larry went to the University of Houston where he studied English and law. A lot of guys I played football and baseball with, I lost touch with some of them, but I've also seen some of them again. We had our 50th reunion a few years ago. When I play golf and I knock the ball in the sand trap, I don't worry about it. I'm a good sand trap player because I was raised around sand traps in West Texas. The Gatlin Brothers' musical career actually began in 1955 in Abilene, just a few years before moving to Odessa, when Larry was 6, Steve was 4, and Rudy was 2. The brothers grew up singing gospel music while listening to James Blackwood and the Blackwood Brothers, Hovey Lister and the Statesman Quartet, as well as other accomplished gospel artists. That's how it got started, Rudy said. Mom and Dad took us to those concerts. Statesman, the Blackwood Brothers, would come through town and sing at churches or the auditoriums or the high schools. Mom and Dad would take us to those concerts and then buy the records and go home and put them on the hi-fi, and we'd learn the songs. Mom would play the piano, and we'd grab a part and start singing, and before you know it, everyone heard about us and we won a talent show for it in Abilene. Slim Willett heard it and soon put us on his television and radio in Abilene on KBRC-TV. Then we moved to Odessa in 1957. As children, the brothers would sing for anyone who would listen. It wasn't long, however, before they were singing from coast to coast and appeared at the World's Fair in 1964 in New York City. They recorded 4 gospel records early in their career. Well, we sang gospel music around Odessa and around Texas, Larry said. That was our first love, gospel music. We traveled around West Texas and sang on some shows. That was our main thrust. In 1971, Larry auditioned for the Imperials, Elvis Presley's backup group. Larry didn't get the job, but he met singer-songwriter Dottie West, who was the opening act for Jimmy Dean. Dean would later become one of Larry's oldest and dearest friends. West was initially taken with Larry's resemblance to Nashville songwriter Mickey Newberry. She said I looked like Mickey Newberry and I should be able to write a song. So I sent her a few songs and she sent me a plane ticket to Nashville, Larry said. Larry and his wife Janice soon moved to Tennessee. Through West's friendship, Larry met Chris Christopherson, who championed his talents as a writer and singer. Christopherson's introduction to Fred Foster at Monument Records resulted in a recording contract with the label, and Larry's first album, The Pilgrim, was released soon after. In 1975, Steve and Rudy, who both went to Texas Tech University, joined up with Larry, moving to Nashville, and it wasn't long before they formed their band, and the rest became history. We had a van and a trailer, and it was very small, Steve said. It was the three of us. In the early 80s, we did a tremendous amount of touring. We were out on the road and worked for 14 nights, and then be off for 2 weeks, and then be back. The brothers have performed all over the country, playing gigs at the White House, the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, Air Force One, Ford's Theater, Camp David, President George H.W. Bush's 80th birthday party, West Point, as well as Madison Square Garden, just to name a few. They have been privileged to grace the stage with legendary entertainers such as Bob Hope, George Burns, Kenny Rogers, Brad Paisley, Rascal Flatts, Vince Gill, the Mandrells, the Oak Ridge Boys, the Gaither Vocal Band, and many others. While the Gatlins have appreciated all of their gigs, they all agreed that their personal favorite was appearing on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson multiple times in the late 70s and 80s. The Tonight Show was probably the most incredible experience because back when we did it, it was the only entertainment show on television at 10:30 p.m., Rudy said. When you went on and did Carson, you were the only music act on television. Think about it. There were CBS, ABC, and NBC. Nobody competed with Carson at 10:30 p.m. That's when we did it. They were like, good luck. There's going to be 4 million people watching you guys right before they pulled the curtain. That'll get your attention. Larry has been the songwriter of the group, and as a solo writer, he ranks fourth on Billboard's Top 40 self-penned hits and was recently inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. In addition, he wrote and produced the musical Quanah, which was performed in April 2017. Larry owes his talent as a songwriter to his English teachers back at Odessa High. The influence for the song All the Gold in California came from an extra credit assignment from his high school English class in which he did a report on John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. I got an A, obviously, Larry said. That was in 1965. 13 years later, in 1978, I was stopped at a red light in a traffic jam in front of the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. Right in front of me is a Mercury station wagon with an Oklahoma license plate. I said to myself, these poor Okies out here remind me of the Jode family and the Grapes of Wrath. They're going to find out really quick that all the gold in California is in a bank in Beverly Hills with somebody else's name. 2 hours later, after a meeting in Burbank, Larry had a song written. The upshot of the story is thank God for my English teachers and for Odessa High School, Larry said. We had great teachers because of the oil-based economy that we had. I had more great teachers in high school than I did in college. I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for the ability to write songs, and I'm grateful for my brothers to help me put it out there. In 2020, the Gatlin brothers celebrated their 65th anniversary in the music industry. They did not think they would make it this long performing. A lot of people didn't think I would live that long, Larry said. I've been very blessed. I've been in great health. My wife and I go to rowing classes for 45 minutes every day. I'm in good shape. I can hit a golf ball as far as I ever could, and I can hit it pretty far. I tell people I can do more work on less sleep than any human being. I'm grateful for good health. Rudy echoed those thoughts. From the get-go, we just wanted to sing and perform, Rudy said. We've been asked this a lot of times, how much longer are you guys going to do this? Or when are you going to retire? And you're not going to run us off that easily. We've said we're going to do this physically until we can't do it anymore. We've had a few throat surgeries, but we're in pretty good shape. It's amazing what we can still do at our ages. Steve described their careers as a calling. I think God has blessed us with three great voices, Steve said. People enjoy listening to us. They enjoy hearing our music. Master Gardeners. Hardy Daisy may be just right for your garden. By Debbie Rowland and Emmy Olmschneider. Four-nerve Daisy, Tetranurus scapuosa, a tough and drought-tolerant plant, might be perfect for your flower beds. The genus name, Tetranurus, is of Greek origin, meaning four nerves, and refers to the whitish to maroon veins visible on the underside of the ray petals. The species name scapuosa, in Latin, translates as stem, and refers to the single stem which bears the flower, making it easy to remember and identify the defining characteristics of this plant. It is a low-growing perennial which can reach up to 1 inch. A lone stem grows out of a leaf clump, and yellow flower heads form as at the end of these stems. The leaves are long and narrow and a silver-green color. Deadheading is a must for four-nerve daisy, as the older flowers look bedraggled as the outer flowers whiten and start to bend down. So deadhead it often and profusely to keep it looking at its best. This plant is native to the dry plains in a central swath from Mexico to Canada, and bounded on the west by Arizona and the east by Texas. It grows in well-drained soil and full sun to light shade. It is perfect for borders and flower beds, and as additions to perennial and rock gardens. It grows slowly and needs very little water once established. Four-nerve daisy will naturalize in dry, rocky soil, often growing where you least expect it. As a single plant, four-nerve daisy can be overlooked, so plant it in groups to attract both humans and pollinators. Although the normal bloom period is from March to October, they often bloom right through the winter months. This means that they are often the only nectar source for any butterflies or bees that might be out and about in a warm spell. In dry conditions, if you crush the leaves and carefully take a whiff, you might be able to smell an unpleasant-smelling rosin, which under drought conditions can be toxic to sheep. However, humans once used the plant for tea and chewing gum. The flower heads can also be used to make a yellow dye. So, if you want a plant that will make you and pollinators smile all year, then this is the plant for you. For more information, call the AgriLife office at 498-4071 in Odessa or at 686-4700 in Midland, or visit aggie-horticulture.tamu.edu or westtexasgardening.org. Letters to the Editor from the OA for Sunday, August 15th. Democrat Hypocrisy. Sandy Milner, Odessa, writes, "The entire Democrat platform is hypocrisy. The Democrats claim to support the Constitution, yet they constantly violate the First and Second Amendments. They claim to be against crime, yet they don't support the police. Democrat-led cities have defunded their police departments, released criminals back onto the streets, and placed so many restrictions on the police that they can't do their jobs. They claim to be in favor of fair elections, yet they are against voter IDs and purging ineligible voters from the voter rolls. They are against audits in states where there is ample evidence of voter fraud, and they refuse to let Republican poll watchers even get close enough to watch the actual count. Now, as if any further proof of their hypocrisy was needed, just look at the immigration situation. Biden is letting literally thousands of illegal aliens flood across the southern border, many of whom have COVID, and releasing them into the U.S. with no restrictions except a court date. Does anyone really expect the aliens to show up in court? Where the hypocrisy comes in is the fact that Biden has told refugees from Cuba and Haiti not to come to the U.S. because they will be turned away. These people are actually fleeing from communism and have valid reasons to apply for asylum. 90% of the aliens coming across the southern border just want all the free benefits which the government gives to anyone except the people who actually need and deserve them. I hope all the people who voted for Biden are happy, especially when they feel the effects of the jump in inflation, causing prices of everything from gas to the food we eat to go up drastically. Congratulations, idiots. Thanks. Dictatorship or Democracy? Deanna Cosper, Odessa, writes, "The more I attend council meetings and read our local paper, I am dismayed by the lack of decorum and dedication our elected leaders have shown. Perhaps dedication isn't the correct word. Oh, some are dedicated, but the dedication is not to the people they serve, which in their words are the taxpayers and constituents. It is their dedication to their own agendas of which the people who elected them are not privy. Let me say I don't believe this of all of our leaders, but even the ones that are not following their own agenda are at the very least not willing to fight or stand up for those they serve. It is sad. The biggest issue right now is the $95 million upgrade of our water system. Instead of educating those they serve, they simply will do certificates of obligation. I have looked up these certificates of obligation, studied up on how they should be used, and the controversy around local governments, using them to circumvent taxpayers' voting. This is all information open to the public. Don't for a moment believe that this $95 million will not come out of taxpayer pockets. That is quite misleading, considering when they applied with the state for these certificates of obligation, they had to state that tax dollars may be spent. They also have stated that they will capture the money with water utility bills. It is laughable that our leaders can even state that the money will not come out of taxpayers' pockets, whether business or an individual, when it absolutely does. Oh, and I agree that the petition was obviously not done as it should have been, but the same goes for the certificates of obligation. I heard a council member state that they did not like when people were asked to sign the petition. They were not educated on what they were signing and misinformed. Our leaders are completely misinforming the people they serve when saying taxpayers will not pay for this upgrade. I heard another council member use the word resent when the petition was brought up. Not sure why anyone should resent a petition, but I know the people that voted for our leaders most definitely will resent when they are paying for this upgrade without getting to vote on it. Education should inspire learning. Matthew Thompson, Odessa, writes, "The sun ascends upon the horizon, illuminating apricot clouds stretched across the pale blue sky, and commencing birds to chirp their festive song. Alarms set the night before by neighborhood children chime for their naive attention. It's the first day of school. The smell of fuel emissions from loading buses and frantic cars and freshly trimmed grass covered in dew reminisce the first morning of kindergarten. I stare intently at the ceiling to adjust my vision to the outpouring light from the bedroom window. I come to the realization it's the last time when Piers and I will wake for our first day of high school. Rose is probing her closet for a piece that fits the acceptable dress code. Tom is stressing about his unfinished book report due by the acceptable deadline. And Gregor is worried he might not play tennis if he can't score acceptable grades. The dilemma for each student arising from school's interference on their judgment, otherwise Rose could choose to confidently express herself. Tom could continue to explore literary classics rather than compulsory reading. And Gregor, not an excellent test taker, could persist to excel at tennis. The regular effect of school on students' creative, academic, and athletic pursuits can sometimes feel limiting. But what force acts behind to undermine each student's growth of personality to express, learn, and develop. In between passing periods, navigating through peers like condensed sardines is overwhelming to fathom. But regardless of how many more students the district can push beyond capacity, 1,000 different names and faces are expected to align with a uniform expectation, ceasing their potential to grow as individuals under the forceful effect of standardization. The education system inhibits independent thought with a standardized formula. The method consists of arriving at an objective destination. Don't fret about losing direction. Students must conform to acceptable thought until reckless whims of curiosity are restrained to an appropriate path. For instance, poetry is likely to be excluded from instruction because of its propensity to have varied and fruitful meaning. Indeed, when poetry is taught in class, EOCs narrow the subjective beauty of poems to dull strategies, methods, and patterns to obtain the right answer. In the learning process, students are trained to think uncritically to fit restrictive pedagogical theory, and the objective treatment of poetry can apply to history, algebra, and reading. In an assembly line, when a product fails to comply with the Texas Education Agency's standard of academic readiness, students are coded as unsatisfactory and sent back to recall. Thus, I ask, who is that student among blurred faces? What makes them exceptional? How do they perceive me? My mind undergoes a symptom of feeling like there's not a single thought that can dissociate myself from peers. The answer to my pending questions is pointless. Standardization isn't structured to cultivate a form of thinking that complements a distinct identity. Peers may have diverse hairstyles and clothing, but nothing permits individual identity because TEA measures do not cherish the construct of an inviolable thought. The district has promised to not return to a one-size-fits-all approach to education, but the district's attempt to reform education should be reviewed with skepticism. Districts across the state, including locally, have contracted the program Naviance. The program calls each student's data into a qualified algorithm, more qualified than yourself, and arbitrarily dictates our interests, courses, career paths, and suggested colleges. The newly implemented program conflicts with the new ideals of the district to recognize and nurture an eclectic learning environment, but characteristically resorts to a degrading one-size-fits-all method. If the district's defense for Naviance is an expedient solution to an abundant population, then the district should first prioritize relieving the capacity of schools before it commits to personalizing education. A core but often omitted voice in education is caused by an unwilling prerogative to trust teachers and students. Although an administrator acts indirectly with a classroom, they subvert the credibility of a teacher's direct relationship with students. The teacher is no longer the guide and director and is discredited for the intimate time spent understanding the hopes, desires, and chief interests of students. In addition, the voice of students is rarely accounted for except on a solitary sheet of alphabetized bubbles. My friends and I feel hopeless because any attempt to address personalizing education is futile. After all, the pessimism of my classmates is not surprising. Antiquated walls have witnessed the same formulaic pedagogy for decades. New technology meant to innovate education has produced more programs like Naviance, digital surveys and assessment reports designed to measure, not foster, the growth of students. Education is a continuous process to inspire students to be reflective thinkers throughout their lifetime. What is the end of a standardized curriculum but to ensure students have retained the right information? What skills of inquiry do we hope to instill in tomorrow's participants in society? Do the rewards of conformity, passivity, and obedience deserve greater value than the benefit of stimulating the curiosity of students. Students docile to the learning process may be a prerequisite to the numbing effect of standardization. To unquestionably accept what is instructed, but an authentic education succeeds in inspiring a world of reflective thinkers, motivated by intellectual freedom, guided by the spirit of inquiry and desire to question the unknown.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.